Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to grow up in America without the essential rights and protections of U.S. citizenship? Jose Antonio Vargas was born in the Philippines and sent by his mother at the age of 12 to live with his grandparents in California, who were legal residents. Vargas did so well in high school and then college that his journalism career took off early. He's even shared a Pulitzer Prize. But he has no path to citizenship or even lawful residency, short of returning to the Philippines and waiting for a decade or more. He struggled even to get a driver's license. 3 years ago, he made a radical decision to publicly reveal his immigration status in an essay for the New York Times. Since then, he has become a well-known activist for immigration reform, yet he still faces the threat of deportation, and a couple of weeks ago, he was arrested by the Border Patrol at the McAllen Airport when he admitted to agents that he is not a legal resident of the United States. Jose Antonio Vargas will be in town this weekend for an immigration symposium at Cathedral of Hope in Dallas and to screen his documentary, which is called Documented. Details are available at kera.org/think. Jose, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have this great faith in the American dream. In many respects, you have lived the American dream. But in the eyes of the law, you are not now, nor can you ever be, truly American.
Yeah. Actually, on Sunday, I'll be celebrating my 21st year in this country. I arrived on August 3rd, 1993. I have to say, by the way, given all the recent conversation about border security, and especially because, you know, I was arrested and detained for a few hours in South Texas, I cannot think of a better place for me to celebrate this than being in Dallas and being in Texas for what I hope to be an honest conversation and a real conversation when it comes to this issue that, as you know, gets incredibly politicized. The past 2 weeks has been really intense just because dealing with now, you know, I finally have a piece of paper from the government that actually says that I exist here in some capacity. And the piece of paper at the top of it, it says waiting for trial for alien. It's my first acknowledgement from the government that I'm actually here. Now, mind you, like the IRS and the Social Security Administration have both known that I've been here for, you know, 21 years. I've been paying taxes and Social Security for like a decade. But people don't know that undocumented workers actually pay taxes and pay into Social Security. So it's going to be a very intense weekend being in Dallas. And thankfully, hopefully, you know, I'm going to get out of the airport and that's not going to be a problem.
What is at stake in that trial that you have coming up?
Well, I'm basically now in deportation proceedings. We don't know what the government is going to do. I'm waiting for them to issue me a date to appear in front of an immigration court. Most people don't realize that undocumented people, you know, to be here is actually a civil offense, not a criminal one. And we have to appear before immigration judges. So that's what's going to have to happen. And we'll see when I get a date. But you know, there's a lot of backlog in the, you know, in the government and in the government courts, in immigration courts in particular. So we don't know how soon that's going to be.
Do you feel as if you're celebrity, given that you have really made this public, does that help you or hurt you at this point?
Oh, I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it's been I've been really struggling thinking about that because it's so weird for me to even be, you know, people are, you know, use that word celebrity, for example. Like, what am I a celebrity for exactly? Like, I'm one of 11 million people who don't have the right papers to be here. Am I therefore more, you know, should I be given more protection because of that? I don't think so. When I decided to do this publicly, you know, I'm a pretty thoughtful person. I, after speaking with like more than 25 lawyers, I thought this through, and I knew that if I'm going to do this, I have to do this in such a way that uses whatever platform and skills and resources I have to marry my story and my predicament and my circumstance with 11 million other people who share the same thing.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's really tough to. I remember when I was, you know, detained for a few hours, and it was ironic because, you know, I went to South Texas to document what's happening with the crisis, with the humanitarian crisis with these kids. And I ended up being detained at the exact same border patrol station as these kids were and as these kids are. And, you know, you're sitting there, and most of these kids, by the way, are what, 8, 9, 10-year-old? They're like walking around. Can you imagine that? We have like 8, 9, 10-year-olds. You know, in jail cells, in a detention center. And for what?
Talk about how you came to grow up here and what you were told when you were sent to the U.S. in the first place.
It wasn't really... I was 12, and my mother said that a better life was waiting in America. I didn't know what that was. You know, I thought she said to me. I remember one of the last things she said to me is, if anybody ever asked me why I'm going to America, I was supposed to say that I'm gonna go visit Disneyland.
Because that's such an American thing, right? That's the kind of thing Americans go do.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So, I got here when I was 12, and I learned to assimilate and to adapt in the ways that I knew I could. Thank God for television. And movies. That was a really big way for me to learn about America. But it wasn't until I was 16 when I went to the DMV to get a driver's permit that I realized that my grandfather was the one who actually paid for me to come here. It wasn't until then that I realized that the green card and the passport that I was, you know, provided were actually both fake. That the man who took me here was actually the guy who smuggled me here. I was introduced to him as if he was my uncle. And, you know, I'm Filipino, so everybody's an uncle. I never met him, but he was my mom said he was my uncle. So, okay, great, sure. But then I found out 4 years later that he was actually the smuggler, that they paid money, and that my grandparents paid – my grandfather paid $4,500 to buy the fake green card and passport. So, you know, to this day, I just – it's interesting to think that, you know, all of this – cost $4,500, which is a lot of money for my grandfather, who was a security guard making, what, $7.50 an hour?
And it was important enough to them to get you here.
Yeah, but they didn't really think it through. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought, I come here, I marry, you know, I work under the table jobs and stay, you know, invisible, which is what undocumented people do. You lay low and you don't say anything. You put your head down, you just work. By the way, that's why immigrants come to this country, is to work, which is why I find it really ironic that we're the ones getting, you know, people think that us coming here is taking away from society and not contributing anything, because that's not what immigrants do. But yeah, so I was supposed to work under the table jobs, and then I was supposed to marry a woman, and that would be a way for me to get my papers. That's what my grandfather had planned. But that didn't work out because I'm gay, and I knew that I was gay since I was probably 16. The same time I found that I was undocumented was around the same time that I was struggling with my sexuality. And growing up in the Bay Area in California, it was just easier for me to come out of one of the closets. So I came out of the gay closet much earlier. I was 18.
And you said that was actually easier for you than revealing the fact that you were undocumented.
Well, yes, it was. But I think that has a lot to do with your environment, right? Like, I grew up, you know, I was fortunate to have been raised in Mountain View in the Bay Area, and, you know, very supportive faculty at my high school. My principal was incredibly supportive. My classmates were supportive. I mean, of course I heard, you know, some words, and my guy friends weren't as friendly afterwards as they were before, but they dealt with it. I dealt with it, you know. But it's really interesting because I outed myself as gay in a pretty public way as well. I did it while we were in, you know, first period U.S. history class after we watched a documentary on Harvey Milk. And the day that I outed myself as undocumented in the New York Times, I heard from some of my old classmates who were in the room when I outed myself as gay, who were like, wait a second, like, haven't you done this already? Like, what?
how can you not have told us that this? And I was, you know, I was like, I wasn't sure how much I could handle. And I certainly wasn't sure that my classmates could handle some dude coming out about both things, you know, like, I don't know. I underestimated my own classmates, I suppose.
You don't have a third surprise waiting, do you?
No, I'm totally. Well, even if I did, I have nothing more to share with you.
Okay, fair enough.
I think we are entitled to privacy. But the moment I did this, the question is, how do I use, you know, whenever I use I, me, and my, mm-hmm. how do I use that in such a way that illuminates people's understanding of this issue and connects it to the larger population of, you know, 11.7 undocumented people in this country, many of us Americans in all but pieces of papers. And that's the struggle, you know, like when you're detained for a few hours, and then of course I was detained, so I had no cell phone, I didn't know what was happening. And then I got out when they would release me, and then I realized just how much news the whole thing cost. I didn't realize that it was like breaking news for a lot of people, and I started to feel guilty after I was released. I was thinking, wait a second, some guy gets arrested and get detained for 8 hours and it's news. People get detained and deported every day and then they don't make the news. You know?
Did you think about lying when you were asked in McAllen about your status?
The lying is over. I made that decision 3 years ago. I lied for 12, you know. I lied to myself. I lied to my family. I lied to my coworkers. I lied to my friends. The lying is over. And one of my friends actually said to me after what happened to McAllen that he was saying that I'm practicing a radical form of transparency, which is true. But again, as a journalist, as a writer, as a filmmaker, my instinct is, okay, what's the story? And just, you know, what makes all of this very surreal is that it's my story, you know. And so when the government, when Border Patrol decides to release me, what they said, they're releasing me because I'm not a priority and they don't consider me a threat. Well, wait up a second. Like, how about the 11 million people? We're not the enemy here. And to think, by the way, since, you know, we're talking to your audience in Texas, like, how many billions of dollars again have we spent on border security? What did Governor Perry just do to send the National Guard? And already, I was just in McAllen. I don't know if you've been down there. I didn't realize what a militarized zone that whole area is. You know, you couldn't go to a Starbucks and not see Border Patrol people. I was in a hotel, and outside the hotel room, or the parking lot, there's, you know, Border Patrol cars. It's a constitution-free, militarized zone in which anybody, they can stop people and ask them if they have papers. And this is like what? Miles and miles, about 100 miles within the Texas interior.
Were you, I mean, do you think that you are being treated differently because you are college educated, middle class, and not Mexican?
Yes, absolutely. And it is my job then to be transparent about that and be honest about that. And, you know, look, this is really hard on my family, right? Because there were some people, I was really stunned by this, because there were some people that were saying, hey, did he try to pull off a stunt? I was asked about this in Anderson Cooper a couple of weeks ago, and I'm like, wait a second, what? I get there. Now, most Americans do not know what it's like to be in a border town in Texas, right? I don't think people in Texas even know what living in that area actually means. I mean, I spoke to people in McAllen, in the Rio Grande Valley, who have lived there for 15, 17 years and have never left and haven't gone through the checkpoints, right?
Let me
people don't
stop
know that.
You have to take a quick break. My guest is Jose Antonio Vargas, a journalist and immigration activist. He'll be in town in a few days. We'll tell you more about that in a minute. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist and immigration activist Jose Antonio Vargas, who will be in town this weekend for a screening of his documentary Documented and an immigration symposium taking place at Cathedral of Hope in Dallas. You can learn more about that appearance at kera.org/think. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Jose, before the break, you were saying that you have been asked by people who think that you got yourself detained in McAllen as a sort of publicity stunt.
Yeah, and I was frankly stunned by that, and this is why. So I get there on Thursday morning to document, you know, actually brought a film crew who's from Houston, what's happening in one of the refugee shelters, right, in McAllen. And then the moment I got there, there was a young woman, Tanya Chavez, who said, "I am so happy you're here. I didn't think you were going to show up, but how are you going to get out?" And I looked at her and I'm just kind of like, what are you talking about? Because they invited me to come, but they didn't think I was actually going to come. Mm-hmm. But I made a last minute decision because, you know, I, like a lot of people, I've been very disillusioned and frustrated by how the media and our politicians are talking about these children. And so I said, you know, I'm going to go. So once I realized that being in McAllen in the Rio Grande Valley, that I was trapped, basically, I had to figure out what to do. So I could either do one of three things. One, I could be smuggled in a car, you know, to get through one of the checkpoints, although apparently the person driving me would also get in trouble if they realized that they're driving somebody undocumented with no papers, no real, you know, no proof of identification to show. I could fly out, which is what I did, flying in, and just risk having to see a Border Patrol agent. Because when I fly all across the country, as I've been doing for the past 3 years, there's never a Border Patrol agent next to the TSA security person checking passport. The only time that has happened is in McAllen, Texas, near the border, right? Or I could stay in McAllen, Texas, until our country and our Congress passes immigration reform. So those were the three options. So I had to figure out what I was going to do. And again, my friend saying practicing a radical form of transparency, what do? I contacted the editor at Politico magazine and I said, I'm going to write about this, which I did. And then I ended up staying in McAllen for a couple of more days because I wanted to film and meet some of these, you know, young people in particular who have been living all their lives in McAllen, Texas, but haven't been able to leave because of checkpoints everywhere. So we did that, and then I made a decision to leave that morning, and I literally tweeted, I think it was maybe like 10 seconds before I got in the line to be checked, to, you know, the TSA line. I tweeted, okay, I'm about to go through the line. I don't know what's going to happen, and I tweeted the picture of my passport and the U.S. Constitution. So that's what I did. And then I guess one of the young groups in McAllen who advocate for immigration reform, actually they tipped off a reporter, a local reporter, that I was going to fly out that morning, which not many people knew. So that's why there was footage. I didn't even realize there was footage, video footage of me getting arrested.
Let me jump in here, though. I mean, as an immigration activist, I mean, yes. I was raised on the border, so I suppose I'm aware of this. But
there you go. That's the main difference.
But it does seem that it would be the kind of thing that you were informed about, that there are checkpoints and that this might occur.
No. Now, don't get me wrong. I've been to Arizona and I'm from California, so I've been to San Diego. I've flown out of Arizona and out of San Diego airports, and there's never been a problem. I've done 300 events in 43 states in 3 years, but I've never been to the Rio Grande Valley. I've never been to South Texas. And mind you, like, this is why in many ways the conversation started, right? And now you have all these articles being written about what a militarized zone that whole area is. Now, the rest of America don't know that. That's why Governor Perry can run around the country trying to get, be elected to presidency and talk about the fact that we need more border security. How much more border security did Texas really need? Especially considering that that's why people are getting apprehended. That's why these kids are being locked up in detention centers. Because there is border security. It's as secure as it's ever been. But we never talk about it like that.
I want to talk about your grandparents who raised you. They were here legally. Is that correct? Or they had documentation that allowed them to be in the country?
They were here legally, and they were actually both naturalized American citizens. But they couldn't petition me because grandparents are not considered to be close enough of a relationship with a grandson. So that's not considered a close enough of a relationship for a petition to work. Hmm. Another facet of immigration. Now, I know the ins and out of immigration reform. I did not know the ins and out of being in a border town in Texas.
Do you, for people who are listening to this and say, well, there must be something you can do now to get legal permission to remain or to get citizenship, talk about what
yes.
you've learned by talking to those dozens of immigration lawyers that you say you've met with.
Well, first of all, I think immigration is the most controversial yet least understood issue in America. Hmm. There's, you know, the reporters, God bless the reporters that cover this issue because it's incredibly complex. But for the most part, it's presented as in a very simplified way. That's why you can have people saying, I am not for amnesty, or we need more border security. Or the question that I always get asked is, why don't you just make yourself legal? Right? As if I find it enjoyable to be an undocumented person who's lived there all of his life, right, trying to figure this out. The only legal recourse for me right now are two things. One, I can decide or I can find somebody to marry because now the Defense of Marriage Act has been repealed. There are several states that allow same-sex marriage, including New York and California. And I can find somebody to fall in love with and have that happen. Now, I just haven't had time. I've been very busy. So I have no one to marry, and, you know, so that's one option. The other option is asking for a Congress member, a House member, or a senator to do a private bill for me, to take care of me. And I don't want to do that. The whole point of doing this is to, you know, this is why we have Define American, and I hope that your listeners visit defineamerican.com, is to tell the stories and expose the cracks in the system, right? And to take immigration out of this box that we've all put it in. You know, this is not a Mexican Latino issue. This is an American issue. And I think we are, you know, we must call on our own history. You know, I've been doing a lot of reading about Ellis Island, and particularly with unaccompanied child minors. I recently found out, are you a fan of Mike Nichols?
The director?
The director.
Mm-hmm.
When I was growing up, I just was obsessed with Mike Nichols. I had seen Fairport in the Park and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and I was just fascinated by who this guy is. And Working Girl, it's one of my favorite movies. And I just recently found out that Mike Nichols was actually an unaccompanied minor who went on, you know, who basically got on a, you know, got through Ellis Island, right? He was maybe 7 or 8, and he was with his brother, and he was sent, you know, by his mom, and they were there, the two boys by themselves, to come to the United States, unaccompanied, to meet their mother. Now, how is that from Germany? How is that different from what's happening now? And this was during Nazism. So how is that different now from what's happening with these Central American kids from Honduras and El Salvador and Nicaragua?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ken in Dallas. Hello, Ken.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate that. I wanted to ask a question, if I may. I was raised in El Paso, Texas. I'm in my late 50s now, so I went to elementary school, junior high school in a small town just outside of El Paso. I assume now, looking back, that many, if not most, of my friends were undocumented. It never entered my mind or occurred to me back then that that might be the case. And I struggled with this kind of question for a lot of years, especially as it's become more to the forefront of this kind of talk. And I wonder if your guest could speak to what his thoughts are on a solution, on a way to address all of this. I don't have one, and there should be something common sense that could be done.
What do you think, Jose?
Well, thank you for the call, sir. And I think actually the American public, if you look at the polls, you know, consistently, the majority of the American public has said that they want to provide legal status for undocumented people like me. There's a poll that recently came out, by the way, that said that an increasing majority of the American public do not want these Central American children to be deported. That they should find, we should give them a way to stay in this country, right? But what we lack is political courage, right? Because what's been happening is a very small but relatively loud minority, especially within the Republican Party, have hijacked this issue and make it not only a political issue, but an incredibly partisan issue. Now, look, I am not a Republican nor a Democrat. I am not allowed to vote. I've never voted, right? I cannot wait to get a chance to vote. But I really do think that when it comes to this issue, we have to get the politics and the partisanship out of it. We have to get it out of it. And it's stuck there, you know, to such a point where the President Obama, you have many Republicans saying that they don't trust the president to enforce the law. You mean the same President Obama that has enforced the law to such an extent that he's deported 2 million people in 5 years? That president? The law is getting enforced, right? People who have ties to this family, I mean, to their families in the United States, parents of U.S. citizens are getting deported daily. If that is not enforcing the law, then what is? But yet, both, particularly the Republicans, have made this, have spread a lot of misinformation about it, right? And are using it just to get elected.
Why do you think there is such resistance to a path to citizenship or a path to legal residency and work permission in this country?
Again, there isn't a lack of resistance with the American public. I think poll after poll has shown that a majority of Americans want a solution and want to provide us legal status and a path to citizenship. The problem is, how are we going to get our congressional leaders, particularly in the Republican Party, to take partisanship aside, right, and find a solution? Think about it. It's been almost 30 years, you know, since Ronald Reagan in 1986 passed, you know, granted amnesty. And mind you, I'm not asking for amnesty. I paid my taxes. I paid in Social Security. This is my home. I'm not asking for amnesty. I'm not asking for a free. I am more than happy to get in the back of a line of a process somewhere. But a line doesn't exist.
But you could, right? You could go back to the Philippines, but you don't want to get in line from there and wait 10 years.
Well, but again, a line in the United States that we can provide, right, a process for people who are here to get legal and to normalize their status. Now, this is my home. This is where I grew up. This is my country. That's why when I went into that, you know, TSA line in South Texas, I've been traveling around with the U.S. Constitution pocketbook since I was 21, 22 years old. Because I do believe that when I read that and it says we the people, I actually think I'm one of those we the people.
I want to talk about the issue of unaccompanied children. As you were, although you had, you know, a family waiting to take you in, they couldn't give you legal permission, but there were people waiting on this side of the border to take care of you. For some of the children that have been arriving over the past few months from Central America, there is no one waiting here who is able to take over their care. There are some just simply practical considerations with regard to caring for these children. You can't just stick them all in a group home and hope that they'll be fine. Can you talk about what you
actually,
think?
Actually, there was a report, I think maybe a couple of days ago from the New York Times that specifically said that many of these unaccompanied minors actually have been released to their relative, some relative of sort, right? And then there are some, as you said, you know, we have to place them somewhere. But I think the reality here is, what, 55,000 children, right? I mean, I heard this amazing story. Judge Jenkins from the Dallas area, who is trying to find or is finding foster homes for these unaccompanied minors. I mean, talk about, you know, talk about illustrating the compassion of the American people. I mean, I feel like there has to be a way. And even if conservative George Will can go on Fox News Sunday and say that we have and we should welcome these kids,
There's got to be a way for us to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Theo in Dallas. Hi, Theo.
Hi. How are you today?
Hi, very well. Thank you.
Good. First of all, I must commend your guest for coming out. It takes tremendous courage to do something like that. I personally came from the worst part of Africa 6 years ago as a student worker. So I was fortunate to have a social security number, which is what I still use to work today. It's incredible. It's incredible how when you think about the whole thing, it's incredible how the government is handling the whole situation. I quite don't understand what it is. I grew up very poor. I came up from a village where I go to farm before I go to school, then go back to the farm, and I managed to get here. When I got here, I realized there was a lot, tons of opportunity here that I could take advantage of. Only setback was I was undocumented, and I've been hiding for the past 5 years, working all kinds of, just name it, any job out there that's labor intensive, I have done. And I have come to acquire that name, hard. I actually earned it, hard worker. Any employer that you speak to about me will tell you how hard I work. And this goes for every undocumented worker that I know. They put in 800% just to get by. I have a daughter, 3-year-old. She's American. I was married once, but it just did not feel right because she wasn't the person I wanted to be with. And
well, Theo, we have to take a quick break here, but I really appreciate your call, and thank you so much for sharing your story. We will talk more about the issue of living and working in the United States as an undocumented resident after the break with my guest, Jose Antonio Vargas, who is a journalist and immigration activist. He will be in town over the weekend for an event at Cathedral of Hope. We will resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about the realities of living and working as a resident of the United States who does not have legal documentation. My guest is Jose Antonio Vargas. He is a journalist and immigration activist scheduled to be in town this weekend for an immigration symposium at Cathedral of Hope in Dallas. He'll also be screening his documentary, which is called Documented. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. We have an email here, Jose, that says, as someone who went through the arduous immigration process and has seen families separated in their attempt to gain immigration to the United States, I can't understand how someone who has broken the law and lives in violation can feel free to stand up and admit his illegality. What gives him the right to become an American citizen when he has cut the line and enjoyed the benefits of American life while so many people around the world wait decades for the same right? I know that's a criticism you've heard before, Jose.
Oh, no. I mean, and I think what's really important is to kind of clear the misconception here, which is that there's an assumption in the email that you just read that I want to jump in front of somebody who's been waiting 15, 20 years. I don't want to do that. I want to be given, people like me, all we're asking for is a process, right, so that we can wait in the back of a line somewhere. A line that doesn't exist. But the other point that the email raised is, and I actually think this is a really, really interesting point, is people seem to think that, you know, why are you parading around, you know, proud of your illegality? That's not what I'm doing. All I'm trying to do is to expose the cracks in the system and the various misunderstandings about the system, right? Now, mind you, no one was threatening to out me. I worked 12 years in American newsrooms. You know, I was making a really good living and I was starting a film career, and I could have just kept working for magazines like The New Yorker and The Huffington Post, and I could have just kept making films, and I couldn't have said anything, right? But I didn't think it was the right thing to do to keep continuing, and so I did this. So would people rather I have just kept quiet, which is what a lot of us do?
How did your friends...
Or would you rather I actually say something and try to expose it?
How did friends react who had not known your status before you came out publicly?
I mean, frankly, some of them were upset that I didn't trust them with the information earlier on, because, you know, some people I've known since I was in middle school, since I was in sixth grade. Some of them I knew, I didn't tell them. There was one friend of mine, I'm not going to name him, but he's a close friend of mine who's a Republican, a gay Republican. Who was very upset with me. And in the very beginning, he actually thought, and this is like a friend that I've traveled with, right? Like a close friend, who actually thought that I should be deported. And then it was really hard because, you know, like I knew him at that point for like 4 years and a close friend of mine. And but, you know, look, I have to be able and be willing to listen to whatever he has to say, right? And then about a year later, he changed his mind and he's like, okay, I've been reading up more on this. You've made me really question, you know, what I think. And I now think that, you know, at the very least, there should be a path, you know, for you to legalize your status. So that's good. But he and I still get in a lot of, you know, conversations and a lot of arguments about, quote unquote, the deserving people. He thinks I'm deserving. And the, quote unquote, undeserving people, people who don't deserve America.
And how does he draw the line between those?
And again, how do you draw the line between those, right? Are you saying that a day laborer who's been, you know, who makes sure that who works hard and, you know, provides to their family and who's here doing a job that many Americans don't want to do, which by the way, is the reality, right? I mean, the governor of Alabama passed a draconian immigration law because he thinks, you know, these undocumented workers are taking away jobs from Alabamians. So what ended up happening? They lost millions of dollars because crops weren't harvested because American citizens didn't want to do the jobs. Right. So are day laborers less deserving? Are people who don't speak English as well as I do, are they less deserving? Is that the question that we asked the Irish and the Italians when they first got here and they didn't speak English at all? Right? Were they not deserving? That's why the campaign that we started is called Define American. How do you define it? Are we as aware? I mean, for me, and I have to go back to this point, it was really very surreal being in South Texas, looking at all the Border Patrol security, thinking of how many billions of dollars we've spent on this, you know, and standing on the line that standing in land that Mexico used to own. Right?
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you have heard from people, you know, you mentioned like the Irish and the Italians who I don't know how much they were asked if they were deserving of citizenship. They certainly weren't welcome socially in a lot of places.
No,
have you heard from people who identify with you because three generations ago, their families went through the same thing?
Absolutely. And, you know, those are the stories that, you know, Define American is going to try to tell in the next few weeks and months, especially because, you know, we're going to get ready for whatever executive order President Obama announces in the next few weeks. Right. And we know, given the partisan rancor of our politics, the moment the president announces anything about this and that he's going to make a unilateral move, right? I mean, you already heard, you know, some Republicans calling for impeachment. It's really going to be important for Americans. One out of three Americans can trace their ancestors to Ellis Island, right? Meaning, actually, there was a time when 12 million undocumented Europeans crossed the border called the Atlantic Ocean and landed in Ellis Island, right? They didn't, there was quote unquote no legal way to do this because there was no border patrol. There was no INS for many, many of those years, right? So what did we do to them? And what are we doing now?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Turi on the line in Dallas. Hi, Turi. Hello. Hi, are you with us?
Oh, yes, thank you. I wasn't asleep. I'm really confused, and please bear with me. My family goes back to a person who came here as an indentured servant back in the 1700s, and then later now I have a niece who, in fact, is dual citizenship, chooses to live in Mexico City because they're more established there. You get my thing I'm saying there. Now, I also understand it. I'm not sure, but I thought back when Ronald Reagan was in office, he had put forth a proposal that people who would come here would be of a better fixed situation, that would be kind of a proponent, you know, for them to be here.
Can you talk about those early, those amnesty programs in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush White Houses, Jose?
No, I mean, they provided, I mean, that was amnesty, right? So for undocumented people who have been living here and provide them an actual path to citizenship. And it was a Republican president and vice president that did that. And I think ever since then, many people argue that when that happened, right, we've already done that once, why do it again? And I would argue that if we look back at what we did then, we can really kind of see the problems, right? We can see how that wasn't really thought through in a way that it should have been thought through, right? And if we're gonna pass immigration reform again, and look, I think in many ways, you know, I think the language that we use is really, really important, right? And people's understanding of this issue and calling it, for example, amnesty, that you don't want to give a free pass to people. Wait, it's not a free pass, right? Considering the billions of dollars that undocumented workers have added to the U.S. economy. I think we just have to get clear, right, on what our values are and what our law needs to be.
Let me ask you this. Since you went public with your immigration status, is it harder for you to earn money? Are there people who say, we would have hired you, but we can't do it?
Well, I mean, that was a big concern of many lawyers that I spoke to who were like, you know, look, you've been working here, you're making a good living. Like, you know, you cannot openly hire, you cannot knowingly hire an undocumented person. It's against the law. Although we all know, I'm sure people in Texas all know that people hire undocumented people all the time and pay them under the table, right? So, but what I didn't know was that undocumented people can actually start businesses. So I can be hired as an independent contractor, right? But I can also start a business. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So we can start our own LLCs. So I run a campaign called Define American, right? It has, what, four people employed in it. But I also have a production company that produced the documentary that I made. So I actually employ and have employed American citizens as an undocumented business owner. And I've heard from people who own mechanic shops, who own construction companies, who have a graphic design firm, who are undocumented business owners. We never talk about that.
How much do you worry about, truly worry about being deported? As of today.
How do I worry about it?
Like, have you thought to yourself, okay, here's what I'll do if I'm living in Manila for the next 8 years?
I was prepared, you know, from the beginning. I was prepared 3 years ago. I, you know, where I would go, what I would do. And, you know, in my mind, I will always be an American wherever I am because this has been my home and this is where I grew up. Right. If you deported me back to the Philippines, you know, first of all, I'd see my mother, who I haven't seen for almost 21 years, 21 years this Sunday, and be reunited with her. But America is always going to be my home. So if I get deported, I have planned and I will plan whatever the details that should be. But what I really worry more about, like I remember when I got arrested 2 weeks ago, the first thing, you know, that I thought of is, you know, somebody please call my grandmother. because I just didn't want her to know. You know, I had warned her that something may happen because I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But thankfully, actually, at the detention center, I asked to make one phone call, and I just called her and I said, you know, Lola, that means grandmother in my native language, Tagalog. I said, Lola, just, you know, it's going to be okay. Don't worry. Whatever you hear about, do not worry about it. I'm okay. So I worry about her more than anything else, really. I've been through a lot and I can handle a lot. And I just hope that Americans, especially the American citizens listening in this conversation, I hope you value what it's like to be an American. Because, you know, for people like me, being an American isn't something that you're just born into. It's something that you actually fight for. Right. And I actually think undocumented people in this country in many ways are showing Americans that America is a fight. And for us, it's worth fighting for. And it's worth the fight.
Do you think any sweeping change in the way we handle people who have arrived here without documentation and may or may not get a path to some kind of legal status, will that start with children, with people who were brought here under a certain age, as it already has in some ways in terms of dreamers and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good way to start, and that's what the president has done with the Deferred Action Program, right? Mm-hmm. That kids who have got here, you know, and who have went to school here under the age of 30, and I didn't qualify because at the time I was 4 months older than 30. And I think what's going to happen now, and I hope sincerely this is what happens, is the president would extend that to their parents, right? These kids are in families, and they have parents who are undocumented. And how about the undocumented parents of U.S. citizens, right? But I think we have to think about it more broadly. For example, so if the president announces an extended deferred action, how does somebody like me who don't have parents here, but have been here for, what, 21 years and have worked here for more than a decade, do I qualify for that? What about a day worker who's worked here for 20 years and may not have children? Does he qualify for that? And again, that's why I think this question of how do you define American is so central and so crucial.
How do you define American?
I define American as someone who calls this country their home. I define American as someone who wants to contribute to this country, because I do think that you have to contribute when you live in this country. And I define American as someone who feels like America is something that we fight for and something we earn together.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a journalist and immigration activist. He will be in town this weekend for an immigration symposium and a screening of his documentary, Documented. That'll take place at Cathedral of Hope in Dallas. You can find details at kera.org/think. Jose, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to being in Dallas this weekend.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.